Welcome to the Decoding Culture Podcast. The podcast focuses on the importance that culture plays in all areas of business and society, from how it shapes organizations, how we work, to how it influences consumer experience, innovation, design, and larger societal trends. My name is John Curran, and I'm your host. I'm a business anthropologist, executive coach, systemic team coach, facilitator, educator, and also cultural commentator. I'm also the CEO of JC Associates, which is a consultancy that helps businesses develop better working cultures and relationships with their stakeholders. I enjoy food. I'm lucky. I've eaten some of the great restaurants and cities around the world. But trying to replicate the most simplest of recipes at home is an ordeal and usually ends in failure. So to offset these failures, I tend to indulge in many hours watching food programs on Netflix and wishing that I had the ability to cook like many of the chefs. One thing that always enters my mind is the systems that are put in place to make a kitchen function and produce quality all the time. How do teams work? How do they learn? And what does leadership look like? And how does team culture influence and is influenced by creativity, consumer experience, and brand? So with my interest in organizational culture and anthropology, I decided to explore this further. In fact, I decided to explore these questions by focusing on the creme de la creme, Michelin star restaurants. To help me with this, I spoke with one of Denmark's leading documentary filmmakers, Rasmus Dinesen, whose most recent documentary is called Michelin Stars Tales from the Kitchen. Rasmus traveled the world over 2 years, spending time in the kitchens of some of the most renowned restaurants, observing and speaking to chefs about what it takes to become a Michelin star restaurant. We discuss everything from how the culture has changed to one where chefs are conscious about team well-being and also sustainability. We explore the concept of the rebel. And also we looked at how the jazz musician Miles Davis's legacy shaped the values of one restaurant in New York. We also go into detail about how teams function in the kitchen day in, day out. It's also worth listening to the end to find out what food travels Rasmus is working on next, and also where he takes his anthropological notebook, and I think I might well have to join him on that journey. So I hope you enjoy episode 4. Rasmus Dinesen, welcome to the Decoding Culture podcast.
Thanks a lot.
It's great to have you. Now, Rasmus, I always touch base with all my guests and want to know, you know, where we're sitting. And we are sitting within these weird times of COVID. Yeah. So like most of my episodes recently, I am in South London in a gloomy, wet, cold, dark kind of London, hoping soon that we'll see some lift of not just the weather, but also mobility. So where are you, Raz?
So I'm in Copenhagen, Denmark, and I guess the weather here is just as wet and gloomy as in London.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a fair point. We're sharing then the kind of the same spirit.
Exactly.
So Rasmus, we've been in contact about your latest documentary, Michelin Stars Tales from the Kitchen, and we're going to get on to that. We're going to talk about that in a bit. But I just want to kind of, for you to be able to share with the listeners a little bit about you, really, and your work as a documentary filmmaker. What got you into being a documentary filmmaker?
I guess I found out that I was somehow an artist, somehow somebody that didn't need to find a job from 9 till 5, studying to law or anything. I found out that, I have to make films. I have to make films about topics that I love myself. And I just jumped into it, actually without any kind of education. But found out that I just have to learn it by doing it. So that was how I got into it.
That's fantastic. Now, listen, I know your documentaries, but again, it would be great for you to share the types of films and documentaries you've made over the past few years.
Yes. Okay. I the first one, actually, where the one where the two of us met, I made this film about football fans during the World Cup in France 1998. And from that on, I went on making a film about the Tibetan football team meeting Greenland. Not only a film about football, but more a film about a country that had struggles with the China and had to try to make a film about what is going on when you are living in refugee camps and want to have a national football team. After that, I jumped into the gastronomy. That's definitely one of my biggest loves. I love good food, and I've been doing that now for two or three films. You talk about now, we have to talk about the Michelin films, but before that, I've been making a film about a Danish chef that becomes the champion of the world champion of fine dining. And I've been doing films about music as well, about following this Danish bass player, old, very legendary Danish bass player, and his struggles in life, being sick in an age and living his life out through being an artist.
That's fine. And yeah. You've also done a documentary about the UN in New York.
That's right. I forgot that one. I did a film about the United Nations, and I followed the Security Council at a time where Denmark was in the Security Council, trying to solve or at least help out in the Sudan region of Sudan in Africa, with still a lot of trouble and problems. But we kind of looked into what's going on when the Security Council and the United Nations tries to help out being a better world.
Yeah, so there's from football to global politics, yeah, and now kind of honing in to the gastronomic kind of creativity also on a global level.
Yeah.
And it's worth, you touched on it, but it's actually worth the listeners knowing that your first film in 1998, based in Paris, in France, in the World Cup, I was the anthropologist presenting it, so that's how we got the bond, and our interest in football definitely kind of crossed paths there.
Definitely, but yeah.
Rasmus, what interests you about being a documentary maker?
I think it's. I found out. I just thought about it today. That I'm controlling my own life. Working methods. It's my films that I'm doing. It's like I'm living in my kind of dream. What would I love to do when I grew old? I guess I'm doing it. I'm doing films about stuff I like, and I'm really into it. It's not the most profitable kind of living, you know, money wise. But I think in all this, all my experiences and all my journeys through all those kitchens and meeting all these special and very interesting people, I'm doing exactly what I want to do at this time.
I mean, that's fantastic, and it's wonderful to hear such passion. You know, doing what you want to do, but not doing it as a means of just financial reward. I guess there's something that I've noticed about your documentaries. I mean, they're all beautifully shot. They've got fantastic narrative to them. But there's also something about, there's a natural kind of anthropological gaze or look that you have, and how you see people, but also groups. You know, and I can look at it from an anthropological point of view and really feel the cultures that you're trying to kind of work with. Is that something that you kind of enjoy doing?
I enjoy it so much. It's nice to dig into what fascinates these different characters. Of course, finding out of I think I found out that it's always very fascinating to talk with people that are so much into their game. It's like only talking with with specialists of their task, and that I find fascinating.
No, that's great. Okay, so, you know, it's evening time here. It's early evening here in London. So as a means of kind of getting that kind of feeling of hunger and temptation, you had this privilege of spending 2 years or so traveling the world, meeting globally famous chefs and going to some of the best restaurants in the world and eating their food. And maybe we should just pause there and kind of recap on how lucky how lucky you were, because that's insane.
Thanks a lot for mentioning it.
Well, there you go. But before, I'm going to actually ask you about the documentary, which is Michelin Stars Tales from the Kitchen. I'm sure most of the listeners will know what a Michelin star is.
Yes.
But what's the history of the Michelin star? Because as far as I am aware, Michelin was a tire company.
Yeah, definitely. It all happened from Paris in France, that this tire company, Michelin, wanted people to drive in their cars and to use the tires. So they made this first little book about where can you find the gas stations and where do you find restaurants near to gas stations. That was kind of the start of the Michelin guidebook. From there on, they found out that this is actually a big international thing. I mean, we can do this in every country, and the people would love to use it. So whenever they come to Paris, Copenhagen, New York, Singapore, and every other big city, they have a guidebook in fine dining restaurants. And from that on, they went on. So no, it's not only fine dining. My film is about the fine dining restaurants, but Michelin also have the restaurants with value for money, and they have the ones that can consistency. What restaurant is consistent every year, showing only the best of what they have every year? So they have more strings to play on, but in my film about Michelin stars, it's the fine dining part of the Michelin book.
Yeah, and so actually the whole rise of the Michelin stars or the book was actually quite functional. It was about you're in a car, this is fairly new, using your car for distance, going on holiday or forms of travel.
Yeah.
And therefore, we're just going to give you some pointers to where you can get a good plate of food.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, so what inspired you then to make this specific documentary?
I met my now colleague Jesper. He called me and asked, I want to do a film about this Danish Thai restaurant that has a Michelin star. Now he want to make a Thai restaurant in Phuket in Thailand. And I said, yeah, okay, that's a good idea. Let's go for that. And before we actually started with the movie, the guy said, well, I can't open this restaurant in Thailand. So I'm saying no thank you at this time. And we thought about, okay, if we have to, we cannot make this film, let's make a film about the Michelin star system. Let's do it like
that. Just like that.
Yeah, just like that, yeah. And then at that time we found out, let's do it. And we called around and talked to different restaurant owners, and would you be interested if we are doing this film, that we will come and check out your restaurant and make a portrait of your restaurant and put it in the film with maybe 15 other restaurants? And that was the start of it. Yeah.
And so let me kind of then think through. I mean, we kind of think about things like funding and stuff. Was this through the Danish television?
Yeah, exactly.
And so you had some. So once you had the kind of, I don't know, the green light in a way to go, how did you go about planning this? I mean, how did you get actual access to the venues and the chefs? And what was the filming process like? Was it spending days in the kitchen? Was it fly on the wall? Kind of stuff.
Yeah. So here we come to what is kind of the dream job for me. Okay, where do I want to go? Where would I love to visit the restaurant scene? And apparently it has always been a thing for me to go to New York. I always heard that they have restaurants from the whole world. And if you can do it in New York, you are definitely a key player in the world. So New York was one place. Where have I never been? I've never been to Japan. And do they have a nice food scene? Yes, they do. So let's go to Tokyo. And let's go to Kyoto. So we have the old school in Kyoto and the more modern school in Tokyo. And that's then where's a very good place in Europe? That's Spain is a great place, and a very nice place in Spain is the Basque country, the old and very beautiful city, San Sebastian. Let's go there. So that was a kind of getting into where we want to go. And at that time, then you found out, what kind of restaurants do we want to go to? Let's find all the 3-star restaurants in those cities. And we called them, and they said, yeah, come. Let's do it.
Okay.
So that was how we started it up.
I've got this image of you and your partner there one night in Copenhagen with some beers or some wine, yeah, with a map, yeah, of the world on the table, yeah, and, yeah, pins, and just putting them where
exactly.
And so imagine then you are visiting these restaurants. I mean, how did the chefs and their teams kind of take you for being there? You're turning up with a camera, and you know, one or two or three of you. I mean, the reason why I ask you the question is it's so similar to the anthropologist turning up, right?
Yeah, I think so. It's kind of the same way. I mean, I came because we are doing this documentary style. It's you don't want to be a big team. You want to be a small team. So tops 3 people, preferable only we would only be 2. So when we came to big restaurants in New York, you know, the leader may be a little high-end chef could be, I'm busy, I'll be there in 2 hours, and you can talk to the staff and you can film a little. Say, yeah, of course, we'll do it. In San Sebastian, we came out to this amazing place called Asabdor Extebari. That's an older guy that found out that he wanted to cook all his food over open fire. And we came to his place, and the first minute he said, come into the kitchen and see me work. He had guests in the restaurant, but he come and film and see me work. And at the same time he said, you want some food? And we said, okay, let's. Thanks a lot. Of course, we want some food. And so while we were filming, he was like ordering or cooking up for us all his specialities. A guy that was the translator for him, being talking Basque or Spanish to us, would translate to English. He would like serve it for us. And so I'm standing there with the camera in one of my hands and a glass of good red wine in the other, and waiting on the steak on the table, having a bite while I was filming. And I said, okay, now I'm really living my job. So that's, I mean, different kind of ways. I would say every chef has their own personality, but in our perspective, all those chefs were very nice to us, and we had a blast doing it.
Did you get to eat in most of the restaurants? I mean, or at least sample the food?
Most of them. This guy, Asador Extebari in the Basque, he invited us while we were filming. The most usual way was after the filming and the interview, they would say, would you care for a dinner in our restaurant? And we would say, every time we said, we would be most delighted. And that was kind of the deal, what was going on, yeah.
So what happened to your waistline? Did it expand?
Yeah, it definitely did. I'm still working on that. But I mean, that's now I'm already almost turning 50, and it's not totally bad. It's not perfect. So that's where I am right now.
I think we're in a similar boat. I mean, Rasmus, I'm massively into food culture, and it's food, I think, is one of the central marks of culture in general and everyday culture, and is what anthropologists usually don't deviate from. It will come in somewhere to a lot of anthropological thinking. So, you know, I can kick back on the sofa and watch, you know, Netflix, The Chef's Table, and, you know, just lose myself a bit. But there's something, again, I find about this documentary, Michelin Stars, Tales from the Kitchen, that it does go deeper. It does have a sense of different lenses, different standpoints, different perspectives. Do you think that's a right kind of analysis of it?
I guess that, what can I say? That, I mean, I think Michelin Stars gives a broader picture into those kitchens. I mean, I like to watch Chef's Table, I would lie if I wouldn't say that I would love to be on Netflix with my Michelin stars. But I think that they right now Netflix bought too much of gastronomy content, so it's not the place where I'm looking for. But I would definitely love to bring my kind of gastronomy films to Netflix or other streaming services as well.
Yeah. Okay, so kind of moving into the kind of the essence of what makes a Michelin star restaurant, and there's kind of this old versus new I picked up quite a lot in the documentary, and I'm going to throw this kind of question out to you. If you were to make this documentary 30 or 40 years ago, what would we have seen then that would have been different from now?
Yeah, I think if we were 40 years back, it would be kind of funny, but that would already be the old days, even though that the restaurant scene has been, of course, here forever. But I mean, 40 years back, it would be a more harsh tone. It would be a more, you know, a terrifying job. I would guess you don't want to make any flaws for the chef to go bananas or be angry or yell or throw with stuff. And I think that's a thing that really happened these days, that chefs are being more, more calm, more relaxed. It's not, you know, also you said before that, or in the older days, I think most chefs would also have too much habits, maybe drinking too much, sleeping too little, not being able to take care of, you know, the more healthy lifestyle. That's also a thing that you see chefs now, like they would run a marathon in the morning, come and have a meeting with the rest of the staff, go home and take care of the kids, come back and be at the restaurant. It seems like that. That thing has been really turned upside down, that now it's a more healthy place to have a job, definitely.
So you talk about that. I mean, that's really interesting because, you know, I think if we probably did a survey on the on, you know, TV viewers on in the UK or in America in Europe, who've all come across that charming guy, Gordon Ramsay.
Yes.
There's a kind of stereotype, isn't there, of the kind of swearing, effing and blinding.
Yes,
kind of head chef who wants to put you in your place. So, are you saying that that's kind of gone now? That we, you know, he's kind of outdated in that type of view.
I guess it's minimized. I wouldn't say it's gone. I think when I visited all those places, they behaved. I wouldn't know what they're doing when I'm not there, but I'm saying it's not a problem anymore. Mm-hmm. I think it's still a business where, you know, the chefs think too much of themselves in the way of, I can manage to work 20 hours a day, no problem. And you can do that when you're young, but you cannot do that when you turn older. I mean, it's going to become a problem for you. And it's going to be a problem for the family life, and it's going to be a problem for anything. So it's just that I also think that it's that kind of job is also it's more hip, it's more modern. It's a place where you want to go, at least maybe especially not right now in the COVID times when everything's closed. Of course not, but I think it turned out to be a much healthier and much more lucrative job. I think also think that wages are better now than they were 20 years ago. I mean, much better. Mm-hmm. So stuff has happened, and it's definitely a place where, that kind of economy is booming when it has a chance for it. So many more countries, like where I'm from in Copenhagen and, you know, in Denmark and Scandinavia, we came so hard on with our food culture the last 10 years. I know England also, I mean, I think England, like Denmark and Scandinavia, we used to have French restaurants and Italian restaurant. That was it. Now we have everything, and also very proud of our heritage and proud of what kind of food we're doing now. So much has happened in this business.
Rasmus, we spoke previously just on the back of me watching the documentary, and you started talking about the kind of this kind of culture of the rebel.
Yeah.
Okay. And I'm just wondering, what does rebel mean in today's kind of Michelin star world?
something happened in Spain with the restaurant called El Bulli. Today it's closed, but they started up saying, what can we do that's never been done before? I mean, there's this example that, you know, every chef would take all the, what do you say, the thing that's inside, the watery thing that's inside the tomato, that we take it out because it's nothing. We can't use it. So that the head chef of El Bulli would say, okay, then I have to make a gazpacho with everything, with the, only that thing taken out of the tomato. You know, really try to be inventive in doing the things in food and gastronomy that's never been done before. And that started a hype in Spain. And then suddenly Spain was the new France. France has always been this place where, okay, they have all the best restaurants in the world. And they do have nice restaurants. But Spain suddenly turned the modern eye on it, and it became something much bigger. So France had to think, okay, what is happening in Spain? So France had to rethink what they were doing. And they are also now rethinking and being more modern. And that came to Scandinavia as well. And Scandinavia, you never heard about good food in Scandinavia. But then suddenly an apprentice that has been in Noma called René Redzepi was hired to open the first, Danish restaurant called Noma that should try to get into this kind of inventive. What do we have in our heritage, our old days, old fruits, old vegetables, everything that haven't been on our menu and the map of the food, let's try it out. And then suddenly Noma became, the world's best restaurant in the world at another ranking system, not the Michelin, but the San Pellegrino Guide, the 50 World's Best Restaurant. And that also turned a big thing up. And I think also became a player that Michelin guide should think about, okay, now there's another player, what should we do? So it's always good with some kind of competition. And, those guys, I think his name is Ferran Adrià, from the El Bulli in Spain, I think close to Pamplona is the restaurant, and René Redzepi with Noma in Copenhagen. They were like frontier guys, spearhead guys to where the restaurant scene are in the world now.
Yeah. I mean, so now if we take a kind of snapshot, what makes then a successful Michelin star restaurant? I mean, what would you say are the key, and excuse the pun here, but the kind of key ingredients?
Yeah, they have some, Michelin have some guidelines to what they're looking for. They're using, are the restaurants using quality products? Are they mastering the flavor and cooking techniques? Do the head chef have personality? Do they give value for money? The consistency of the food, that's the things the inspectors are looking for. And if you are an A+ to all those stuff, you'll get the 3 stars, at least if you can do it over 2 or 3 years in a row. You start with 1 star, somebody can start with 2 star. I never heard about a restaurant starting from 0 stars to get 3, but that might be one of those, but I mean, I'm not sure right now. I can't.
And you're kind of experienced there in the everyday kind of rhythm of the rest. What does leadership look like? I mean, who is leading? Is it very hierarchical? Is it, is it more egalitarian? How would you describe it?
I think it starts by being, the head star or the head chef has a vision. But when he hires people, he can see this guy, he's good at fermenting, and he knows about the pickling things, and this guy, he's a maniac in the fish section, and this guy, he knows everything about how to cook the meat, and so he finds a specialist in each corner, and of course he needs somebody to bake the breads, he needs somebody to make the desserts and the sweet kitchen. And when that's settled, he knows his staff, then it's very flat flat rules. It's like everybody just know what they're doing, and it's like a orchestra playing a very nice symphony of music. It turns out to be very melodical, rhythmic, jazzy. You know, it's a good thing. Yeah.
But that's a really powerful image, actually, of how a team can work, where it's rhythmic, it's an orchestra. So everyone kind of clicking together to create a beautiful kind of sound. Are there times when it's more kind of military?
I guess that, of course, when you come as an intern or apprentice, you'll start peeling the onions, and that's not so fun to do in 10 hours a day in 5 years. I don't know if you saw this film Jiro Dreams of Sushi, also on Netflix. It's like 3-star Michelin Japanese restaurant lying situated under the very close to a metro in Tokyo. Just before you come out of the metro and you go in there, and his son that works at the restaurant, the only thing he could do in 10 years was to cook the rice before he like turned into like learning how to cut the fish. So it is kind of military disciplined, but it's more the discipline that's important. There's no time, or there's no space for a fuck up, you can say. Don't do any customer. Let all customer have this amazing feeling sitting here. It's gonna you have to, if you are in a 3-star Michelin restaurant, usually you feel like the time is flying. You're only there. You're not thinking about the politics, the COVID, the what's going on at your job, at the family situation. You are enjoying your life full because you're eating something that will give you this kind of feeling that, wow, it's just amazing eating and drinking, having a good time, sitting with friends, sitting with colleagues, stuff like that.
Yeah, in the documentary, I think the restaurant, is it Aska in Brooklyn?
Yeah.
And the head chef there, is it Frederick Berzelius?
Exactly.
Is
that right? He's a Swedish guy living in New York, yeah.
Yeah, and I picked a quote out there. He said, everything should make sense the moment you walk through the door.
Yeah.
And it kind of, if that's the start point, that's quite impressive. That's the top. And then how that has to work then, from a team point of view.
Exactly. And all those chefs, they really say every night, okay, this was good, let's do it better tomorrow.
Okay.
That's how they are. I mean, they're never satisfied. They can always see the sauce can be another way. If the guest had the dish at the table 5 seconds before they had it, it would taste better. The temperature would be perfect. You know, they are very hard on themselves.
Are they hard on themselves? But is everyone hard on themselves?
Yeah, definitely. What I noticed, at least at this place, Aska in New York, that was also a total team effort, and they knew exactly what to do, and they would say afterwards what was good and what can we do better tomorrow. And we're talking about one of the best, maybe 500 restaurants in the world, and they're still talking about we have to do it better.
Okay, yeah. There's also this thing, I think it was one of your previous documents, but this image was, you know, head chefs now are on skateboards and they're listening to hip-hop.
Yeah.
You know, is that a fair kind of reflection?
I think that guy, he was a skater before and he loves hip-hop music. That's why I had it in the movie. I think it can be everything. But, I mean, it's common that, when they're not in service and they're prepping, there's always radio or music going on. And I mean, it can be everything from rock music to hip hop. Not that much classical music, I would say. It's more, it's more the different chefs, what they want to hear, they're listening to. But of course, when the service is on, it's all about the customers. Let's give the customers the best experience they can have.
Carrying on with that kind of music metaphor, there was also something interesting. And this is kind of going into this idea of creativity, but not just necessarily the recipes, but thinking about the holistic, the kind of who we are, the brand, the overall feeling. And I think it was Daniel Hum, the chef at 11 Madison Park in New York, who started using and researching Miles Davis, the jazz musician, as a means of getting a kind of sense of who they were as a restaurant.
That's right. I asked him about, what is this Miles Davis? There was like a big picture of Miles Davis in the kitchen. And he said, yeah, but his first, the restaurant journalist that should comment on how the dinner was, he said, it kind of lacked in Miles Davis. And it's Daniel Hum was thinking, what does this journalist mean? So he started to listen to Miles Davis music and thought, wow, he's a good musician. And okay, he's both free and he has some nice themes, and he has a lot of words that he digs. Right now, I can't remember the words, but in 11 Madison Park in New York, a really nice and classy 3-star Michelin restaurant, they have these 7 words that they found out, Miles Davis has said, that would give sense or make sense for the team in the kitchen to always look at when they are on job to make the evening perfect.
Yeah, and this there was, but I was really taken by this idea of some of the restaurants would shut for a period of time, so for over a number of weeks, and it would be a chance, a space to kind of re-enter into a kind of creativity zone about new recipes, new menus.
Yeah.
Is this something, though, that is just done by the head chefs, by the kind of cream within the team, or are the junior staff also bought into that sense of creativity and invention?
You're talking about, let's see if I can, it's the restaurant called Mugaritz. It's also in San Sebastian, and they close 3 months every year to wipe off or wipe out all the dishes that they had last year, and now it's time to find new dishes. And we're talking about a restaurant that's definitely or minimum have 25 to 30 dishes at a menu a night. So he would get staff, mostly junior staff, find the guys that he believe in, and then they just start out trying out, keep testing. Let's make 40 new dishes. Let's find the 25 of those 40 dishes to be the menu, and that could take that could definitely take 3 months. But it's everybody working. It's of course it's the head chef Andoni Aduris that's working around and testing and trying out and giving maybe a little bit more salt, maybe a little bit more. You know what he can. That's always nice that there's somebody that's like having the last word, but everybody was in the process to come to that point where let's open March 1st and be a good restaurant again.
It's a really interesting point that, because I'm kind of thinking about, well, what's the benefit there? Okay, is the head chef thinking it's his responsibility now to keep the junior layer of the team engaged or feel that they're wanted, or is he actually seeing benefit that they too, as the junior, although they're junior, have a sense of creativity and they have something that he can learn from?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, a guy like this will be he will get something out of finding the new prodigies that can make something crazy, and from that time when he finds these guys, then he's worried that they will quit and open their own restaurants, because I mean that's how it goes. I mean, every good chef, at some point, they would try to be on their own foot and they open their own restaurant, and that's also good for us clients. I mean the better and the younger the new chefs are and opening or starting new restaurants, better for us.
Yeah, it'd be good for you as well. You can make endless documentaries on food and eat wonderful food. I think it was the chef, Kevin, is it Ferling, of the Taste restaurant in Hamburg?
Yeah, the table in Hamburg. And the reason why I remember it's called The Table is because the restaurant is one long, what do you say, curvy table. So you're sitting at the same table, but it's very long and very curvy, and like an island somehow around in the restaurant. And yeah, he started this. He's told us, I mean, that they should work less, and like kind of get rid of that kind of stressful life, working too many hours and stuff. And he said that had been a good thing for that restaurant, that everybody worked less hours, and they came, when they came on work, they were more relaxed and more hype to good make a good effort, and not so much of that being too tired and living a too stressful life.
Yeah, there was a really interesting point there, because I remember him kind of balancing this reality of, you know, your number one thing is positive turnover, but to achieve that you need a healthy staff that are happy.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's kind of something that could be a mantra that is missed out in many different industries.
Yeah, I think so.
To actually be successful, you need to have staff that are engaged and happy, right? So it's, you know, he used this word fun, and also kind of said, well, look, it's no longer the perfect service, right? But it's, there's something else. And I think also, I was really taken by, is it the Danish, I think he's Danish chef, Klaus Meyer?
Yes, yes.
And again, the quote he said was, the restaurant is a tool to create value of what was around it, or what is around it.
Yeah.
And I kind of started thinking about, well, that's so many different ways you could take that. Is it just ingredients, so local ingredients? But is it also about the culture around you and who you are and where you are? So it's this kind of almost now playing with the concept of a restaurant. And I think at Muritz as well, Jay Gross, who was the R&D, head of R&D, yep, there, said, yep, it's not a restaurant, but enhancing an experience.
Yeah.
It's an amazing step change there, isn't it, about what our perceptions of a restaurant are to it being something else.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I guess that's what the Michelin system, or being on top of that system, having three stars, that's, it's more than just the very good food. Of course, the food has to be the key player. But after that, it's about, of course, the service. It's about the ambience. It's about enhancing where are we? And do we feel it through what we're eating? They talk about when you are having like a fresh made cheese from milk from from the cow the same morning, and you feel like that you can hear the cow say moo, and you can almost taste the grassy flavor or aroma in the cheese because of the cow walking around eating nice great grass and stuff like that. I mean, that is amazing when you have these adventures as a guy eating the food.
Is there something around also kind of, I think there was something about chefs take social responsibility seriously, and
they really do. Yeah, I mean, many chefs knows about everything about you know the better food comes definitely from you know animals being free, the organic veggies, you know, everything that can make a difference. Of course, and right now I'm in the editing room. Doing my Michelin stars the sequel, you can call it, about this totally remote fine dining restaurant at the Faroe Islands.
Okay.
Living or the restaurant is situated in a valley where the sheep and the chickens are running around free, and the scallops and the sea urchin they are having it from day to day of divers getting them on the bottom of the ocean, and so everything is so fresh, so sustainable, so free range, so organic, in such an amazing place in the most beautiful setting. And that's, I mean, of course, that's a big thing for the restaurant, and that's why they have two stars now. They'll probably get a third star sometime very soon, I guess. But that place is just such, such an amazing place to be.
So you were making this documentary is purely on one restaurant in the Faroe Islands.
Yeah, I was about to make a number two around the world, but because of COVID, we found out that's not the right thing to do now. Travel around the world. Now everything is closed also at Faroe Islands, they also because of the COVID, but for us it was good to just be at this young guy. He's only 29 years and he found out that we never at the Faroe Islands thought about what is our heritage, and he's nice and easy trying to find out, and they're making stuff from old days but turning it into more modern and using techniques from Germany, not Germany, Japan, and French techniques, Spanish techniques. He's doing everything, and it's definitely a must go if you like food like this. Yeah.
Well, it sounds like an acute kind of destination if you're going to go there. Rasmus, the documentary itself. What's happening? I know. Of course, it's being shown in Denmark, but what's the plan for kind of more general release?
We hope, still hope that it will be sold to many countries. But we did sell it a lot before we made it to. You know, we sold it to Japan, to Germany, to France before the film was actually finished. So it is. We're still kind of selling it, but now we are already, of course, thinking about making new films. I'm also just finished with a film about the food and the wine experience together. What kind of food and what kind of wine goes good together? The wine pairing with the food and the, you know, a film only about the good life, eating and drinking.
Yeah, why not?
You would definitely turn hungry and thirsty when you see this film. And hopefully we will talk about that film another time. But it'll be done and on the market soon. But because of COVID, of course, it's kind of hard to sell that much right now. Everything is kind of in a low gear in that sense, you can say.
Yeah. Okay, so Rasmus, I kind of asked this question to end the podcast to all my guests.
Yeah.
So I'm going to kind of symbolically give you the anthropological or the anthropologist's notebook. So you can go and study any organization or any environment you want to for a year.
Yes.
So where are you going to take this book? And it doesn't have to be food related.
It doesn't have to be food related. I actually, because of the COVID and because of things shutting down, I've been a lot in my... we have a summer house on a little island in Denmark called Samsø. And I for the first time I was there from March to April. And I was lucky, or we were lucky, my family and I. The weather was perfect and I went on a lot of walks. And I found out I have to come back a lot more at this island. I mean, I'm there in the summertime. But I found out that I would love to be there for a long time and just studying. I mean, it's a natural place. It's got so beautiful scenery, a lot of beaches. That's it's of course coast all over the island, and so many veggies are coming from Samsø to the rest of Denmark, and also exported to other countries in the world. I would go there and check out how to get closer to nature, get closer to all those beautiful veggies and all those animals also running around there, just being free out there. It would be nice to be there.
Fantastic. Well, listen, we'll look forward to hearing more stories from that, and also waiting for Michelin Star's Tale from the Kitchen to come to the UK, other parts of Europe, the US, Australia, and also to the Faroe Island documentary. Sounds absolutely fascinating. But Rasmus, thank you so much for being a guest on the Decoding Culture podcast.
Totally my pleasure. Let's do it another time as well, for sure.
Okay, thank you, Rasmus. Thank you.
No problem. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Decoding Culture podcast. I think in 2021, in the world of business, teams will be a key focal point. So I hope the conversation with Rasmus will help you start thinking about the importance of team culture. I'll put some of the links to Rasmus's work and his other documentaries in the show notes. If you're interested in organizational culture and also how to decode it, I'm running a training course in partnership with Epic called Leveraging Organizational Culture for Impact. This starts on the 25th of February, and I'm running it twice this time so that those interested from different time zones can sign up. The details will be in the show notes. Please do subscribe to the podcast feed, and please feel free to give it a podcast rating on iTunes. And to keep up to date with interesting trends on culture, business, and anthropology, sign up to my Decoding Culture newsletter. The link will also be in the show notes. See you next time.